All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're taking a look at a case that I think really, if you're going to be a lawyer, in particular, if you're going to be working in the tech space at all, you're going to need to know about this one. Computer Associates International, Inc. versus Altai, Inc.
Yeah, this is a landmark case,
Yeah.
not just because of the outcome, but really about the methodology that the court applied. And we're going to look at two things in this deep dive. One is exactly how copyright law protects the non-literal elements of software.
Right.
And the second is, can a U.S. court judgment prevent a lawsuit in France? Ooh la la.
Ooh la la, indeed. This really does cut to the heart of some of the challenges that we have in the modern world with software development. We want to encourage innovation, we want to encourage competition,
Yeah.
but at the same time, there are legal protections in place, and then you throw in the fact that this is an international case, different jurisdictions, and it's really fascinating. So let's dive into some of the facts of the case.
Right. So back in the late 1980s, we have Computer Associates, we'll call them CA. They develop a program called Adapter, right? And it's basically a program that allows their job scheduling software to run on a variety of IBM operating systems, like a translator for computer languages.
Yeah, it's like the Rosetta Stone of job scheduling
Like it.
software.
And so a former CA employee by the name of Claude Arney moves to Altai, a competitor.
And this is where it gets a little sticky, right?
This is where it gets interesting. So Arney takes some of that adapter code
Ah.
and uses it basically as the basis to create a similar component for Altai's job scheduling program, which they called Oscar 3.4.
Right. So that on the face of it sounds like just straight up copying.
It does. It
Yeah.
does. However, Altai then stopped selling Oscar 3.4, and they do what's called a clean room rewrite for their next version,
Yeah.
which is Oscar 3.5. They bring in a whole new team of programmers who have never seen the CA code and basically say, hey, we need a program that does X, Y, and Z. Go.
Yeah. So CA sues Altai in US court, alleges copyright infringement, alleges trade secret misappropriation theft. But I think one of the biggest things that comes out of this for people that are studying law now is this question of, we're not talking about literal copying of the text of the code. We're talking about the non-literal elements. Like what is the dividing line? When does something go from just functionality to creative expression that is then protected by copyright?
That's exactly right. And this is a really evolving area of the law at the time. And one of the huge things that comes out of this case is this test, the extraction filtration comparison test.
Catchy name, catchy name.
Easy to remember.
Yeah.
But this is applied by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right.
And it's meant to answer that question, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do we look at these non-literal elements of software and determine whether or not they've been infringed?
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, it's broken down into three steps.
Right. That's right. So the first step is what we call abstraction, right? And think about it as peeling back the layers of an onion or the layers of the application.
Okay.
You're starting with the very high level, what does this program do?
Right.
Like, what is its purpose?
Right.
Then you get a little bit more specific. And you say, okay, what are the modules or the structural elements within this program? And then you get even more fine grain, maybe down to specific algorithms, data structures, and finally the source code itself.
Okay, so essentially you're going from like the what down to the how.
Exactly. Exactly. So you've got these layers. Then the next step is filtration,
Okay.
right? And so as we're going through these layers, we need to filter out the elements that are not protectable under copyright law.
Okay.
What are some examples of those?
I would imagine just like the general idea, like in a book, if you have an idea for a book, that's not protected. It's the expression of that idea. So I imagine it's something like that. Or maybe if something's already in the public domain, like a library, or I don't know if that's the right word to use, but if there's code that's already out there and available to everyone, you can't protect that.
Yeah, public domain is exactly right. You also can't protect things that are dictated by efficiency or external factors. If there's only one way or a very limited number of ways to achieve a particular function, that's generally not copyrightable.
Okay. So you're looking for those unique elements, the creative choices that the programmer made, like their fingerprint on the code.
Exactly.
Oh,
So
that's
we've done
interesting.
abstraction, we've done filtration.
Right, so we got two steps down. What's the third?
The third step is comparison.
Okay.
So now you're taking those protectable elements of the original software,
Right.
right? Those things that we've identified through abstraction and filtration, and you're comparing them to the allegedly infringing software, and you're looking for what's called substantial similarity. Now, this is not just about the literal code. This is really about whether or not the structure and organization, is similar in a way that would constitute infringement.
So applying this three-pronged test, what did the district court decide? What were the findings on the two different versions of Oscar?
So the district court found that Oscar 3.4 did infringe CA's copyright.
Right.
And that was largely because, you know, remember there was some direct copying of the adapter code by Arnie.
Yeah.
And so that resulted in this substantial similarity. But they found differently for Oscar 3.5.
Okay.
And that clean room rewrite was critical.
Yeah.
Right.
So essentially they were able to achieve the same result, but in a different way.
Exactly. And that's the point of the clean room, is to say, can we achieve the same functionality without replicating the expression?
Yeah.
The way that CA wrote the code.
Yeah.
Right. The expression.
Okay. Now, what about this trade secrets claim?
Right.
What happened with that?
So the district court initially dismissed the trade secret claims.
Mm.
And they said, look, it's preempted by federal copyright law. The idea was that copyright law was already covering this. There's no need for state law trade secret claims to get involved.
Okay.
But the Second Circuit didn't agree with that.
Right. They vacated the dismissal. Right. What was the reasoning there?
Yeah. And so they vacated that dismissal, and their reasoning was pretty straightforward. They said, look, copyright law and trade secret law, they both deal with intellectual property, but they protect different things.
Okay.
Right. Copyright law protects the expression. Trade secret law protects confidential information that provides a business advantage.
Okay.
Right. The way I think about it is trade secret has that element of, we're not going to tell you how we did this.
Yeah, the secret sauce.
The secret sauce. The recipe.
Okay.
And, you know, typically trade secrets are also bolstered by these confidentiality agreements.
Right.
And these obligations. And so the Second Circuit said, well, you know, there are different rights here. We're going to kick it back down to the district court, and we're going to allow them to reconsider those trade secret claims under Texas state law.
So that's a really important point about preemption and when federal law will essentially take over and say that state law doesn't apply. It's not automatic. There are these nuances. And the court looked at the different aspects of what is being protected and said, you know, it's possible that both of these could coexist. But ultimately, what ended up happening with the trade secret claim?
So ultimately, the district court found that, look, CME might have had a valid trade secret claim, but they said you waited too long to bring it. The claim was time barred under the Texas statute of limitations.
Well, so even though they might have had a valid legal argument, they missed the deadline.
They missed the deadline.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we talked about this U.S. case, but this also had some international implications because CA filed another lawsuit against Altai in France concerning Oscar 3.5.
Yeah.
So now we have this question of, well, what is the reach of U.S. court judgments?
Right. Yeah. Does the fact that a U.S. court has said something prevent a French court from saying something else about the same matter?
Exactly. And so in response to this French lawsuit, Altai goes back to the U.S. court. They're like, hold on a second. We already dealt with this. Can we get an injunction to stop CA from pursuing this lawsuit in France? And they make two arguments based on these doctrines.
Right.
One is called res judicata.
Okay.
And the other is called collateral estoppel.
Okay.
Big words, but they have fairly straightforward meanings.
Yeah. So essentially they're saying, look, we already dealt with this in the U.S. You can't just go forum shopping around the world. So the U.S. court looks at that and says, you know, you make a good point. What was the U.S. court's decision on that? Did they say, yeah, France, you can't look at this anymore?
Well, ultimately they said no. This lawsuit can proceed.
Okay.
And the reason why is really interesting. And it gets into the specifics of what res judicata and collateral estoppel actually mean. So, res judicata, right?
Yeah.
Also known as claim preclusion. What does that mean?
As far as I understand, it means that you can't keep bringing the same lawsuit over and over again.
Exactly.
Like once there's been a final judgment on the merits of a claim, that's it. It's done. You can't just go and refile it in a different court hoping to get a different outcome.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
The problem is that in this situation, res judicata didn't apply for a few reasons. One, although the French case involved Oscar 3.5, right?
Yeah.
The allegedly infringing conduct was the distribution and sale of Oscar 3.5 in France, which happened after CA had filed its initial lawsuit in the U.S.
Oh, okay. So new facts.
New facts. Still.
It's not just a retread of the same thing.
Exactly. And typically, res judicata only applies to the claims that existed at the time the first complaint was filed.
Okay, that makes sense.
And so the court said, well, this conduct happened later, so it's not covered by res judicata.
Right.
Another problem was that in the French lawsuit, there was a defendant called Faster, which was Altai's French distributor.
Okay.
And they were not a party to the U.S. case.
Oh, so different parties.
different parties. And for res judicata to apply, the parties in the second lawsuit have to be the same, or what we call in privity, with the parties from the original lawsuit.
And I'm guessing the U.S. court didn't have jurisdiction over Faster.
You're exactly right.
Yeah.
The Second Circuit said, look, the U.S. District Court in New York did not have personal jurisdiction over Faster. Faster didn't have enough minimum contacts with New York to be sued there. So they couldn't be bound by the U.S. judgment for the purposes of res judicata.
Okay.
And they also determined that Faster wasn't in privity with Altai for the purposes of this lawsuit.
Okay. So res judicata is a no-go. What about collateral estoppel?
All right. So collateral estoppel. Little different. It's also called issue preclusion. And this prevents the relitigation of specific issues that were already decided in a prior case, even if the claims are different.
Okay.
Right. And the requirements here are that the legal standards governing those issues must be identical in both jurisdictions.
And that was the problem here.
Exactly. Altai argues that, hey, the U.S. court already found that Oscar 3.5 didn't infringe under U.S. law.
Right.
So the French court should be bound by that finding.
Right.
And they can't decide differently under French copyright law.
Right. But that would be assuming that U.S. law and French law are the same.
Exactly. And the Second Circuit said, you haven't shown us that. You know, you're asking us to basically tell the French court how to interpret its own law, and you haven't convinced us that French copyright law, especially as it deals with these non-literal elements of software, is the same as U.S. copyright law as we applied it in this case.
Okay, so in essence, the U.S. court is saying, we're not going to step on France's toes. You know, they have their own legal system. We respect their sovereignty. You have to make your case there.
Exactly.
Okay, so big case, lots of interesting stuff. What are the big takeaways that people should remember?
So number one, the extraction filtration comparison test.
Right, the AFC.
The AFC.
Mm-hmm.
This became the standard methodology.
Huge.
Huge. For analyzing copyright infringement in software, non-literal elements.
And this is still being used today.
Still being used today. That's number one. Number two, federal copyright law does not automatically preempt state law trade secret claims.
Right. They can coexist.
They can coexist.
Okay.
And number three, U.S. courts are generally not going to enjoin litigation in foreign countries over the same subject matter, especially when, as in this case, there's conduct that happened later, there are different parties, and there's the possibility that foreign law is different.
So I think what's so interesting about this case is it really highlights the tension between, you know, we want to encourage innovation, we want to protect intellectual property rights, but also in this increasingly globalized world, how do we respect the differences between legal systems and make sure that one country isn't overstepping its bounds?
Right. And I think you hit it on the head. This has huge implications for businesses, especially those that are operating internationally. They need to be aware of these issues.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our deep dive on Computer Associates v. Altai. Hopefully this has been helpful to all of our listeners out there who are interested in technology law and intellectual property law. As you continue your legal studies, think about this. We live in an increasingly interconnected world.
Yeah.
Software development, distribution, none of this respects national boundaries anymore. So how do these principles that were articulated in Computer Associates v. Altai continue to influence how intellectual property rights are enforced across the globe, especially as we have new technologies, you know, things like AI, blockchain, the metaverse, all this stuff, you know, that operates without regard for borders?
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how these concepts of non-literal infringement, clean room development, these limitations on enjoining foreign litigation, how they're applied to these new technologies that are really pushing the boundaries.
Exactly. It's not just about knowing the black letter law, but also understanding how to apply those principles in a rapidly evolving world.
Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we hope you learned something new today.
And we'll see you next time.